Welcome to the first Jinx broadcast. I'm Jack Galloway. I got in touch with Ted Annemann and asked him what he thought about this project that was going to be based upon his original work, and Ted thought it was a great, great idea. So with his blessing and eternal help, this project is set out down the dark road and around the bend. I prefer to think of this as a conversation taking place in a nice cafe or cocktail lounge. I prefer to drink gin, but y'all can choose the beverage of your own desire. I was speaking on the phone the other day, and a friend said it sounds like we're putting together an exclusive teaching lecture series that you would have to pay a good chunk of cash to attend. And I guess the Jinx broadcast does fit both of those descriptions quite well. We invite you, any of you, listening to participate and contribute, either via the written word, by phone, Skype, or on the forum. Ted did the same sort of thing with the original Jinx, and we are going to continue that type of interactive dynamic with this broadcast. If you have a specific item from the Jinx that you would like us to feature and offer variations, improvements, applications, just send an email and we'll do what we can. You could also suggest or submit ideas on the forum. In fact, that might be the best way to keep in touch. But Ted and I will leave that up to you. I will post the topics for the upcoming broadcasts on the forums. So if you have any questions or want to contribute before we do the broadcast, you may do so. The broadcast will take place on a bi-weekly format. The reason this project was undertaken by Ted, the Dead Boys, and myself is because over the past few years, I've had long conversations in person and on the phone with several performers and artists about mentalism, paranormal entertainment, and interactive performance art, as well as some pretty epically heated debates on the forums that some of you may remember. But as I see it, no great change or advancement is ever made without great conflict and struggle, because most people like or benefit from the status quo. I see parallels now between the Impressionist painters and the conflicts and advancements now taking place in our field. Anyhow, the topics covered in those phone conversations would cover a wide and kind of intertwined series of topics and philosophies, but all related to the one presentation. My opinion is that the information exchanged in those conversations would be of use to those with similar interests, specifically the people listening now and that will take part in the forum. So for these broadcasts, I have a list here of some of the things we'll be covering in addition to the presentations from the Jinx. We'll talk about seance work and video tools to enhance your show, acting, linguistics, compliance techniques, hypnotism, group organism dynamics, vocal tools, background music and sounds, character, attire, giving readings, ethics, and I have 10 or 13 other things on here that we'll be going over, not on each show, but kind of touching here and there. It struck us that the best way to do this type of show was to explain the creative process and then provide the many varied ways a tool or principle can be exploited. That is where Ted's inspirational Jinx comes in. We will be taking effects and tools and presentations from the Jinx, and we'll examine how they can be improved and applied in different ways. You know, it has been a bit of an eye-opener to find out how few people, even pros, have not read Ted's original work. I know that a lot of you have the book Practical Mental Effects in your library, but really, that book is just a compilation or condensation of the original work. It's a thumbnail sketch that it in my opinion, it lacks the depth and the color. See, the guys from that time period, the Dead Boys, really had a different vibe than the kind of mental magician presentation so prevalent today. You see, in the Jinx, you get a true picture of who Ted was and is, and also the other performers of that time period. Oh, a quick note here. If any of you are interested in getting the original Jinx or some of Ted's other writings or books that have been written about him, you can contact Mark Reed at Magic Vault, and I placed a link. I guess it's on the forum. It will also be on the page where you get this broadcast. Now, over 50 years ago, there's a famous quote by Ted, and it was him offering the opinion that it is the effect that counts, not the method. and that bit of opinion has influenced me and numerous others over the years. In fact, I take that even further, and we will talk about that at another time. I'm trying to keep this first broadcast kind of under a half an hour. However, a lot of modern performers miss that the presentation is part of the method. In almost all instances, it is the major portion of the method. But so many never learn that important lesson or are afraid to take responsibility for what they create, just as any other performance artist would, or even a painter or musician. I guess since this is the first show, a bit of warning is in order before we get down to the first presentation from Sid Lorraine. There is no doubt in our collective mind that some of you will be at odds with some of what we will be discussing. A good measure of it might be considered provocative or controversial content, and some ideas expressed in the language used to express them would not be considered suitable for children or people of a delicate disposition. So please play fair with me as we do with you and consider yourself warned. I don't want to receive email slaggings or complaints on the forums because you're upset with the content and decided not to heed the warning. This show is intended for mentalists, paranormal entertainers, performance artists, and those who, as I say, deal from the dark side of the table. However, anyone is welcome to listen, of course, but just don't send in emails or post about ethics. We will not debate the subject with you. However, we will be commenting on ethics and the lack of them on the next show. So, those of you who enjoy... Those of you who enjoy pulling things from under rocks and exposing them to the bright light of scrutiny, you should find the next show interesting. Let's do the first question, because we do have a first question from one of our listeners. And I know what you're thinking, that being, how can you have a question from a listener if this is the first Jinx broadcast? Well, it was offered by the Professor Slim King, a good friend of mine, when he heard about this project. And, you know, it's a good question. And it's being answered here as the first listener question, because I know he will be listening. And what is Slim's question? Well, any of you that know the Professor Slim King knows he has a great unwavering fondness for rum, but an even greater love of money. His question is, are you going to charge for this thing? How are you going to make any money off this? And yeah, it's a good question, and one that has a lot of weight considering what we are offering, and that Ted has not put out anything in years, and my own work was and is released pretty exclusively. Quick side note, I am currently working on a new project called Summerland that will be released in about 30 days, but we'll talk about that then. We did consider putting out the Jinx broadcast as a series of DVDs or CDs, but since you are listening to this now, you know you have not paid a thing so far. Except, of course, with a bit of your time and consideration. And so far, a fair and equitable exchange, I say. But do let me say this in response to Slim's question. Anything worth having has a price. This broadcast is not free. I am paying for it. Ted, Harlan, Stewart, Al, and the other dead boys paid already. So it would be nice if you remembered and thanked them from time to time, because they know when you do. Yeah, we'll cover the price of things at another time, possibly at the end of the show or at some point down the road. But now it's time to get to Sid Lorraine's offering from issue 131. I have the original Jinx right here. I had to take it out of its spring binding so that I could read it easily. And I'll read the original effect in that Sid wrote. This is Sid writing. The performer introduces a pocket dictionary. The spectator looks through it, has a free choice of any one of the many printed words. The word is written by him on a card, and it is inserted momentarily into the dictionary. After a moment of concentration, the spectator pockets the card and hands the dictionary to the performer, who immediately opens it and reads aloud the word chosen together with its definition. Sid continues. If this were a dealer's item, I might emphasize the following points. Absolutely no force, no carbons, no mirrors, no loose page inserts. Comes complete with a beautiful imitation leather dictionary, 24 imported cards, and the very important gimmick. So, That's what Sid writes. He also continues, and this is interesting for historians of mentalism and magic. The working is simple. There is ample misdirection, and believe me, the principle is quite old. It is an ideal pocket effect, and if I should mention that I puzzled such folk as T. Nelson Downs and Stuart Judah with this some 10 years ago, maybe you'll be eager to give it a try, even after reading the almost childish explanation. So this thing goes back a good ways, and you have Sid telling you that he fooled some of the greatest minds in magic in his time with this. Sid continues, the secret lies in the use of a second dictionary, unknown, in parentheses, let's hope, to the audience. The type used by me is obtainable in 5- and 10-cent stores, and it's about 3 by 6 inches, with the cover title Webster's Dictionary, 40,000 words. The duplicate is mutilated by cutting out a section from every inside page and the back cover. In other words, your dictionary has a complete cover, but the balance of the book has a window through the middle. The first illustration on the next page will make this clear. Of course, I can't show you the illustration right now. So what it is, it's a peak book. And the hole in the back of the dictionary is slightly smaller than a business card. Let's see. Sid continues. Several visiting cards are required. They should be of such a size that when one is inserted into the book, as per the second illustration, about 1/4 of an inch protrudes. The size of the window in the book really is governed by the card size. So that means, I think you guys get the idea that the card won't go all the way into the book. That's so that it's easy to find and pull back out. And also the window that you're going to be looking through that's cut into the back of the book is smaller than the card, so the card doesn't fall through. And I guess you could use up to an index card if you so chose to. And let me see. Okay, here's his setup. Sid's setup was in the right coat pocket is the gimmick dictionary, in your left coat pocket have the cards, and he says he doesn't care where you keep the pencil. So I think you get the idea of what happens. We might as well cover Sid's routine, and then you'll hear what I came up with for this, and you'll see the difference in how these things can be changed up, if you would. Start by saying, these are Sid's words, start by saying that the average person, when asked on the spur of the moment or even on a street corner to think of a card, finds it difficult to think of a real hard one. They might suggest house, rabbit, or if you've been doing bad magic, they might be smart enough to quickly produce the word lousy. But offhand, they cannot come up with a Muscovado or anything like ethnographic. So in order to make it easier for them and a headache for you, Mr. Webster's Pocket Dictionary is introduced. Explain, I have to move the, there we go. Explain that the spectator is to run through the pages on second pass. Okay, explain that the spectator is to run through the pages and freely select any word he cares to and firmly impress the word upon his mind. You know, editorial comment here. Mentalism patter hasn't changed considerably, has it? Then he is to write it down on a card, which you hand him. Next, ask him to turn the card with the writing side down, and at the same time, you retrieve the dictionary. Don't mention this. Don't mention the dictionary at all. Keep talking about the word he has written. During the talk, casually place the dictionary in your coat pocket and instantly come out with the gimmicked one. You're looking and talking to the spectator. If anyone notices your hand and the book, he should get the impression that you have tried to insert the book into your pocket and, finding it difficult, have placed it aside, which you do. Still talking to the spectator, you walk away from where you have placed the gimmick book and try to get an impression of the chosen word. You fail after a couple of attempts, picking up the book, and you ask the spectator to insert the card writing side down somewhere between the pages. Be careful not to expose the back of the book during that time. Turning the book on the edge and quickly steal a glance at the written word, which can be read easily through the book window, as per the third illustration. As you turn the dictionary around, still apparently looking at the edge, you say, I see you've inserted the card at about where the letter R starts, or mention whatever other letter the word may begin with. Another piece of editorial comment. I guess they've been using that psychological angle for a long time. Immediately return the card to the spectator and say, that's a bit of unconscious help you've given me. I know the word begins with the letter R, and as there are only 8,000 words beginning with the R, it narrows my field considerably. At this point, you open the dictionary, still being careful as to not flash the back or the cut pages. Look up the word you now know. If it is not there due to the cutout pages, you can name it just the same. If you should, if it should be there, then the best presentation is to give the name and read the definition. At the conclusion, put the dictionary in your pocket or switch back and leave it around. Let's see. As you pocket the dictionary, or to cover the exchange, you can say, I'm glad you picked the word, that word, sir. As you pocket the dictionary, or to cover the exchange, you can say, I'm glad you picked that word, sir. Last evening, a fellow picked the word nothing, and when I asked him to concentrate, he had nothing on his mind. It made it extremely difficult for me. So now we know how old that line is. And I suggest none of us ever use it again. Now let's look at that was Sid's presentation for the use of this tool. I think it's quite good. There are a lot of subtleties in there that people may not realize or think about. What especially struck me was some of Sid's instruction, especially the idea of, after you do the switch, placing the dictionary down. So you're placing some distance between you and the dictionary, and you're leaving it sit there for a while. And what normally will happen is the people you're performing for will remember the dictionary just sitting on the table, or that you took back the dictionary and sat it on the table, because that's where it ended up. There was no reason to remember the in-between piece, because at that time the dictionary was being taken out of play. Sid also makes the point that this is to be a casual type of presentation. Now, that bit of instruction might be the most difficult part of using a tool such as this. It takes practice and pre-thought of just how you will move and what you will do and what you will need to do. Your actions must be choreographed, and that means considering as many variations as you might encounter. And really, the choreography extends to your language also. You see, when an actor rehearses, they consider how they will say a line and all of the possible ways that line might be offered. When you are totally comfortable with a tool or a presentation, you can be at ease and casual. You can kind of be in the moment and one with the tool and the presentation. I know it sounds a bit new age, but I think you all know it's true. Here, let's look at an example outside of the world of entertainment, kind of make the point. The first time a person picks up a power tool, for instance, a circular saw, a power saw, how do they handle it? If they are like you and I, they will do so awkwardly. You will see muscle tension, and they will just appear generally ill at ease and very cautious. But now consider a carpenter or a builder, and the ease and casual nature and confidence they exhibit because of how familiar they are with that tool, and the actions that they've done so many times before. Muscle tension is replaced with self-assured ease. But how many times have we all seen performers that are too stiff and appear nervous and focused on their props or tools in a disproportionate way, and in doing so, they diminish their performance? Now, the big question, how do you practice being casual and offhand? Well, the most important thing, especially in this case, is to become comfortable with the tool, the peak book. My suggestion would be start off by keeping, in this instance, the gaffed book with you for a few days and not using it. Just take it with you places, carry it around. So you get used to handling it. And also so that you never expose the gaff. You always just make sure nobody ever notices that hole. And after a while, you'll just do it. Kind of muscle memory takes over. You just get used to it. You'll become comfortable with it. Also, get used to just how simple, the simple action of placing it down, you can glimpse the target in a fraction of a second from an oblique angle. You can also hide the glimpse by taking back the pencil with the same hand that holds the book, or by pointing with the book in your hand. There's no doubt you can come up with other ways to choreograph the method of the glimpse or the time of the glimpse other than the method Sid suggests. His is good, but like I said, you have to learn to cover all the angles just in case one option might not be the best at some point in time. If you only have one way, you could end up exposing yourself or, like we just talked about, appearing nervous or paying too much attention to the book. You always need a way to get home, as I say. Then you need to practice in your head again and again the best way to say what you need to say to make the presentation go forward. Of course, this is scripting. And in my opinion, not enough people do it. They think they can just wing it. Some of you may know Mick Ayers, a good friend of mine. Mick does over 1,200 shows a year for Disney. And every year he sits down and he scripts a new act. He takes the old act and he offers it for sale to other professionals, other performers. And it's his complete act, the methodology, the whole show, but it's all scripted out. It is a true script. If you ever see Mick perform, you can have a script sitting there. And of course, he'll go off script and improvise, but he has that framework there to go back to move his performance forward. My personal method is head scripting. I drive or go for long walks, working out all of the ways to say it and do it in my head. Here's a little bit of, a little bit more on being casual and controlling a performance. When you want somebody to do something, think of how you do it in everyday life. You want them to do it, and you frame the command as a question. Will you pick that up for me? It's not a true question or request. It's more of a command. And also, a lot of commands are nonverbal. You just put out your hand and you look, and the person naturally complies. And you'll start noticing this in everyday life, how many times you do it and how natural it really is. And then you start applying that to these sorts of presentations. Also consider that this tool or the method of the Peak Book, this is just the way Sid decided to put it to use. Those who have my DVDs know I put this methodology to a totally different use than Sid did, using a phone book, and I turned it into a prediction effect. But I really can't share that with you. I just wanted to bring it up that is something that's out there, and some of you may come up with the idea just by hearing that. You might be able to figure out what I have done. But here's something else to consider. What if you combined this with another book test? My personal suggestion would be one of the outlaw books, if you were going to do a formal show. Because who's going to suspect you would have a gimmicked, antique, rare piece of memorabilia like that? And who knows, maybe Rick in the future and Outlaw Effects will put out a Peak Book companion to go with some of their other books. I think it'd be a great idea. I really do. And then the same thing could be applied to tarot cards or business cards. It's just a Peak tool. And this is something I started doing years ago, and that's what I'm going to share with you now. It's a presentation I first came up with when I was maybe 20 or 21, and it's based upon a deck of rising cards that I bought when I was in eighth grade. So however old you are when you're in eighth grade. Anyhow, it had a hole cut in the back, half the deck, and as did the card box. And somebody would pick a card that would be put back in the half that has the hole cut in it. And you would hold the deck up and make it rise out of the cards. I hope that explanation is sufficient for any of you wishing to do that version of the rising cards. But when I was maybe 20 or 21, it occurred to me that this could be used as a mentalism effect. And since we just did this and I realized it's really the same sort of technology, the way I was using it, that's what I'm going to share with you to kind of demonstrate how these things and these tools can be expanded and used in different ways. Well, the original version that I did, I just would have somebody pick a card and they would write something on the middle of it and place it back in the deck. And I would do that because I had no business cards. I had nothing else to write on. So here, since I'm doing card tricks, and of course I would have done a deck switch, and I switch things rather extensively when I'm doing corporate work, and this is more of a corporate presentation or something that you might do at a cocktail party. So here, take a card and just write on it. Give them a Sharpie marker, and they write something in the middle. They slide it back into the deck, and you put the deck in the case, and you catch the glimpse when you place it on in your inside pocket. Or if you're not wearing a shirt, you could also glimpse it as you put the deck into your back pocket or place it on the ground. And people aren't going to mess with it because it's been kind of taken out of play. And in that time, you glimpse what they've written inside that frame. Now, that was originally what I did, and it worked nicely. It really just, I think, a better way, a better version of a peak wallet, because it was, just seemed more natural in the environments I was working. But as you can see, same methodology, and at the same time, you can always do the rising cards if you want. This is how I do it now. And really, it's considerably different when you start looking at this. And I'm holding a deck of cards in my hand right now. And the way it works is this. I, at one time, went through a lot, three or four decks of cards every show I did. So I can make up forcing decks. I would suggest you do the same. Or the half of the deck that you are not going to cut a window out of, go through and make sure they're all cards that you can write in the middle of. No kings, queens, or jacks. And I also wouldn't suggest a three or a five. So you have all of these other cards to choose from. You put them all on top. And the other 26 cards you cut a window through. I put the two of clubs on the bottom of the deck now, hiding the hole that's been cut through it. Now this is how it plays out. My preference is I glimpse the card when they take it. As I said, you could create a forced deck. It could even be just two or three cards on top, and then you can go fishing. So the person picks the card. At that point, you say, I want you to take a few steps back. You hand them a marker before they do so, and you show the bottom of the deck of cards, which has your two on it. You just say, the card you chose, is there a space in the middle like here where you'll be able to write something? And you get confirmation. Well, why do you do this? Because you can handle the deck now and not worry about that space being exposed. You're at ease. You're at comfort. You're in the moment because you don't have to worry about that. But you're going to expose that hole so that you can use it in just one moment. You point to the two, and you say, well, good, what I want you to do, look at your card. As you do that, you're showing the two, your left hand comes over, and you take the two off the bottom of the deck, and you hold it up to the person. And you say, well, in that space, and you point with your index finger or your middle finger as you're displaying the two so that it looks natural. I just needed a way to get that two off the bottom of the deck. Of course, you could always cop it off and replace it on the however you want to do it. This is how I do it. You say, what I want you to do is just look at the very center of your card. Don't let anybody else see it. Don't let me see it. I want you to imagine a quarter in the middle of that card, right dead center of that white space. See a quarter. Can you tell me when you can see that quarter? Imagine that quarter right in the middle of the card. So you're putting a little bit of, you're using a compliance technique because you're going to wait until they say they can see it. And since they have no reason not to say they can't see it, they are going to go along with you. This looks good for the rest of the audience. It plays well. The reason you're doing this is you now ask them, I want you to take your marker, and I want you to draw a circle all the way around that quarter that you see. And so now they're working on something that they're evidently hallucinating. Nobody knows what's going on yet. Then you're going to move along to, I want you to think of, this is my presentation. You're welcome to use the house number thing if you want. I want you to think of the first house number or apartment number you can remember from when you were a child, the earliest number. And if you were an apartment, there might be letters associated with that, or you understand, right? And the person says yes. So they write it. Nobody's seen it yet. What I want you to do now is turn that face down. I'm just going to open the cards here a little bit, and you just open a little break. You keep your right fingers on the front of the break so they cannot insert it into the upper half. That if they do, you're not going to be able to peek it. So they slide it in, you let it close, you retrieve your card box, you slide it in, and as you're closing it, you can glimpse that information. So up until this point, everything seems fair. They're not sure what you're going to do. They're going to assume that you're going to tell the person what they've written. But my angle is, look, I'm going to show you the difference between what I do and what magicians do. Even though I am a magician, I do other things, and that's what I'd like to show you. See, normally a magician would have you pick a card. He would do some fancy shuffling. You've all seen that. You definitely know how a magician works. But that's not what happened here. You took out a card. Then you saw a quarter appear on it, and you drew a circle around it, and you placed a piece of information from your childhood into the middle of it, and then you placed the card back in the deck. There was no fancy shuffling. It was placed directly back into the deck of into the case, right where you put it. Nothing's been changed, and now we've put the cards and your information away. First, I'm going to try to get your card as a way to link up, to see what you see, to draw a link between the two of us. And if I get it wrong, that's all right, because even that reaction from you will help me get closer to you. So now, what are we doing? We're doing something strange. You're drawing a link. If you do this seriously enough, people will believe this. And you just take a guess. You know what the card is because you've glimpsed it or forced it or however you've chosen to do it. If you're going fishing, you're just going to call out either red or black. And if you don't hit it, that's fine. Don't use that old joke. If you call out black, if you call out red and it's not, please don't use the joke. Oh, I was thinking of black cherries. That's just don't. I think it's way overused and it never works well. So if it's wrong, let's say you hit it wrong. You say, hey, that's all right. I saw the reaction, and I felt the reaction from you. You felt a little bit sorry for me, a little bit nervous because it didn't work, that I might have got it wrong, and that's perfectly all right. But it's drawn me closer because I saw how that miss, how it acted upon you. What I want you to just, now I know definitely that it's, and you'd play whichever side you missed on, red or black, whatever, and then you hit the suit. And people, believe it or not, people always respond to this, especially if you know from the start and you call out the correct color and then you hit with the suit. People are impressed with this because it seems so impossible, it doesn't seem like a card trick. It's at that point I diminish what's happened, kind of put it all into perspective, so what comes next is even more amazing. First, when I hit the color, I say, hey, wasn't anything big. It was just a 50-50 shot. And then when I get the suit right, I say, remember, 50-50, same thing again. But this is a little bit harder. I would say that it's an odd card and more than likely a 7 or a 9. And this, of course, is dependent on what you have forced or the card that has been chosen. It's always very effective to give two numbers, as if you're not sure. A magician would just come right on out. Don't do it. Don't do it. Give it that leeway, because the last target is going to be absolutely spot on. Remember, you are building towards something. You're not trying to kill people one time after another. You're building a cathedral, okay? So it's either a 7 or you just name two cards that are close and they're separated. It's either odd or it's even. And for some reason, this really works for people. The people that really think realize that both cards were odd. It wasn't one was odd, one was even. So there you go. And they will confirm which it is. Let them do it. Let them be part of the presentation. Now you're going to go for the house number. And the way you build this up is by saying, we're going to work together to build this image. That's what this whole presentation has been built on up to this point. That's why I had you see that quarter, because I could see the quarter in my mind. That's the first thing that came to my mind. Actually, the reason you did it was to make sure that they write in the correct place on the card, because they're going to write their number in the middle of that circle. So it's in the perfect place. It's a way to make that happen, to move the presentation forward. But now you want everybody that's watching, including that person, to see what you're seeing in your mind as you build this this scene for them. And the first part is, where was the number? Was it an apartment? Was it a house? Did the number appear on the mailbox? Was it on a house or on the house? Was it on the door? You get the idea. You need to know where the number was. Possibly they remember writing it on a paper when they were in school. You'll get all kinds of answers here. Then you're going to build a few more things. If it's on the mailbox, what did the mailbox look like? Was it on the house or was it out front? And you have to practice this so the questions just come one after another, as if you're a police officer interviewing them, and you just keep on one question after another. What, if it was on a door, was it a wooden door? Was it a metal door? What color were the numbers? Were they block numbers, or were they in script? Were they old? Were they rusted? How old were you when you saw this? And then you start, I see it. I see the door. Things are a little bit blurry. Then you're going to pick one of the numbers. Don't blurt this whole thing out. You're going to pick one of the numbers, not the first one. And you come out with whatever number. Let's say it's 7. Let's say the number's 172. So you come, is 7 one of the numbers? Yes? It's the middle number, isn't it? Because I'm not getting a clear image, but I do think that's the middle. Yes. At that point, you say, I have it then. And you just name the whole thing as if it's come right. I see it on the door. The number is that. Is that the same number that you see in your head? What's important there, you don't mention that it was written on the card. This whole time, you've been separating yourself from those cards and from what was written down. Remember, we brought up that she imagined seeing that quarter. She visualized that quarter. It appeared, and then it disappeared. Okay? So you've totally separated yourself from it, and you've created this whole image and something that most people would perform just as a card trick. You now have a double revelation that you get credit for hitting or at least narrowing in on that first card as you build to this to the climax of the presentation. And since the cards are away, the whole thing's done. And the first Jinx broadcast is also done. I hope you found something that you can use here. And we'll come on over to the forum and contribute if you have any ideas on how to use a peek book, any suggestions, way to improve either my presentation or Sid's, or have one of your own you would like to share. We would love to have it. Any ideas for future shows? I look forward to hearing those, too. And since this is the first Jinx broadcast, I would like to use Ted's words that he used to sign off on the very first Jinx so many years ago. In Ted's words, "So it is with lifted glass instead of broken bottle, I dedicate instead of christen the first copy of the Jinx to a memory." Y'all have a good night.